My vision is clear, the future is here.
Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome out to yet another edition of ThisWeekInGeek.net's Botched Role. I'm your host, Mike the Birdman Dodd, who has recently survived critical hits to his torso. Recently, if you've been following my Twitter and Facebook, things have been, well, interesting of late, but I'm here today. Finally, the Twig Studio has been restored. We got one of our editing computers back. However, though, during the last couple weeks, during the Twig Studio crash, we actually lost a few episodes of Botched Role, so hopefully we're going to re-record those in just a couple of weeks, so sit tight. But until that time, I want to bring you guys something special. I've been in contact with the good folks over at Paizo Publishing. You guys know them primarily as the publishers of the Pathfinder adventure game. Basically, the 3.5 edition open game license, wonderful world of Galarian. I've talked to people like Owen Casey Stevens. I've talked with Tanis O'Connor. She's one of the people behind the Pathfinder adventure card game. And I got offered by their PR person, Jenny, to speak to someone rather special. And it didn't even hit me until I read the email a couple of times over and over again. And I looked at the name and I'm like, Jason Bowman, why do I know that name? Jason Bowman, holy shit, this is the lead designer of Pathfinder. And you can hear him on the other line right there. So without any further ado, I bring a guy I never thought I'd actually get a chance to talk to. I'm here talking with Jason Bowman, the lead designer from Paizo. And we're going to talk Pathfinder today. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey there, Mike. Glad to be here before the con damage does you in.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It has been brutal. And let's hopefully I make my next fortitude save before the end of this particular podcast. So I got to say, it is a honor to speak with you about Pathfinder simply because this is the game that sparked my personal renaissance back into tabletop. And to speak to someone who helped, I think, bring the hobby right back into really big kind of prominence right now is something kind of special.
Well, thanks. You know, I just, you know, kind of was like trying to make the game that I wanted to play. And fortunately, that also happened to be the game a lot of other people wanted to play, too.
So I guess what is the origin story of how you got involved in the kind of game industry? Because I understand you had a pretty, I wouldn't call it a boring job, but you did something fairly impressive. Like, you were an architect or something before this?
Yeah, before I got my start in the game industry, I was an architect. I graduated from college and worked in the field for a few years. I've got a number of buildings that I helped design back in my hometown of Milwaukee. I was doing that for years. And during that period of time, you know, I'd been a role player since I was a kid, right? I grew up in Milwaukee, and Gen Con was in my backyard, and, you know, I've been to, you know, every Gen Con since 87, and, you know, so I've been doing this for a long time, and I started volunteering for the Living Greyhawk campaign for the RPGA, and during that period of time, I started writing adventures. I eventually got involved in campaign management. I became an independent contractor for Wizards of the Coast, and then I started, you know, I had my first ever published work. You know, I had an adventure in Dungeon 114. And, you know, at that point in time, Wizards had a job opening, and I applied for it, you know, hoping to become a developer for Dungeons & Dragons. You know, it was kind of my dream since I was a kid. You know, it was the dream that supplanted being an astronaut. you know, I applied for the job and went through the entire process, but they offered the job to someone else. I didn't really have too much professional writing experience, so I understand why they offered it to someone else, but I did take second. And during that same period of time, they hired some other folks for some other positions, and one of the positions they hired took an employee from Paizo and brought them back to Wizards of the Coast, Paizo originally having been spun off from Wizards of the Coast a few years previous. So when Paizo had an opening and they learned that I took second, my good friend and previous boss in the RPGA, Eric Mona, who was helping helm Paizo, offered me the job that got vacated at Paizo. So that's how I kind of ended up in the game industry. You know, I was there for the magazines through the end. I was the managing editor of Dragon for its last few years in print. And after that, I kind of was tinkering around with, you know, some home rules, and I knew that we knew that 3.5 was about to be replaced by 4th edition, and I was just kind of playing around with 3.5, thinking, you know, hey, maybe some people might want to, you know, have an update to their game. And originally I was just going to do it as like a PDF. That, I mean, my original documents were literally called 3.75. That was kind of my initial thought. And as the months rolled by and Paizo was in talks with Wizards to become kind of a full-throated 4th edition supporter, we just kept waiting for the rules, and they just weren't showing them to us. They were just delays and delays, and it got to the point where we were running out of time. We had to do something. Because, you know, production schedules being what they are, if we wanted to have products out at that year's Gen Con that had any relevance at all in the face of a new edition of D&D, we had to figure out something to do. And we could either, you know, sit around and hope, you know, that when 4th edition came out that there was a compatibility license for it and we could work with that, or, you know, we could, you know, keep printing 3.5 stuff. And I floated the idea about taking my 3.75 stuff and making a game out of it, kind of running with that. And everybody kind of took a look at it and went, yeah, all right. And that's been my job ever since.
Wow. So when you had a chance to, like I said, update the rules to, like, from 3.5 to the own unique thing that like, kind of Pathfinder does, what were some of the deficiencies you found in 3.5 that needed updating?
For me, my basic process on that was just kind of flipping through the books, and whenever I saw a rule that I knew I had to look up every time it came up in play, that rule probably needed to change. So, you know, for example, grapple, you know, just to take the easiest one. You know, whenever anybody grappled in 3.5, out came the books. The books were required to figure out how to grapple. No one could remember the rules. They were too convoluted. I mean, you know, there were some that could, but most people had to immediately look them up and figure out how it worked. And I was just like, okay, well, that's probably too complicated, so let's try and streamline that. You know, turn undead, you know, was just like, oh, what's that chart? Oh, it's all weird and it doesn't make any sense. Let's go look it up. You know, so things like that were kind of my prime targets. That was kind of the easiest stuff to identify that needed to be fixed. Beyond that, I really kind of looked at the system from a player user standpoint, saying, what am I not getting out of the game? What is breaking my verisimilitude, and what is not allowing me to kind of tell whatever story I want? And there wasn't a lot, but some of the problems were rather subtle. One of them was characters had a real identity crisis in 3.5. Most characters had very many classes. They would be like three or four multi-classes all stacked on top of each other, because that was inherently more powerful than just sticking with one class. So one of the things I really wanted to do was to make sure that the classes themselves were strengthened, that their core concepts were strong enough and defined enough that you actually were less interested in swapping out of your class to make some sort of weird hybrid character. And part of that solved one of my other problems, which was just there, a lot of classes had levels where you just got basically nothing. You would get hit points and skill points, maybe a save bonus or an attack bonus, but you wouldn't get anything special. It was just kind of like the standard routine leveling stuff. So in finding ways to strengthen the classes, it also led me to giving them all class features at almost every level. That way, you know, as you go up in level, you are always getting something new. There's always something to look forward to. So, I mean, yeah, those were kind of some of the big things. There were some system balance and polish stuff that went into the game as well. But ultimately, right, you know, we wanted it to feel and play like the 3.5 everyone had been playing for years. So, you know, we actually kind of restrained ourselves in a lot of ways.
Now, one of the cool things that really attracted me to Pathfinder is the fact that you guys created your own world, your own kind of narrative that didn't have 30 plus years of history from, like, say, Greyhawk or Forgotten Realms or whatever. What went into the creation of the world of Golarion?
Well, Glaring was a very big collaborative effort between almost our entire staff at that point in time, because creating a world is an incredibly complex and convoluted problem to solve. So we had the Adventure Path team, who desperately needed a nation that was detailed enough for them to write adventures in. That was the first thing they needed. But beyond them, they also needed places around them that they could reference and name drop. And, you know, it's kind of hard to say, okay, there's a nation, but we don't know the names of any of its neighboring countries, right? You know, you need those almost right away, right? Not because they necessarily play a big role, but it looks really weird on a map to just have a country floating in the middle of nothing. So, you know, while the Adventure Path team was detailing Barisia, Eric and I kind of sat out to have some meetings and kind of flesh out the rest of the world, or at least a good enough chunk of it that we could really kind of have something to sink our teeth into. So we really kind of focused just on the Inner Sea region. That first map of, like, you know, Avastan and Northern Garund was just kind of, that was our home base. That was like, this is where most of our adventure is going to take place. And it started out with some brainstorming meetings, just kind of being like, okay, well, what types of games do people want to play? Okay, people want to play horror games. Okay, so we need a nation that is suitable for horror games. People want to play, you know, pseudo-fantasy Egypt games. Okay, we need a pseudo-fantasy Egypt. You know, so we just kind of came up with a huge list of all the places that you would want to have adventures. And then it just came time for us to, you know, slowly over various iterations, we trimmed that list or added to it, and eventually it came time for us to put together a map of what we thought that might look like. And that started out with Eric's infamous T-shaped map, which was like six pieces of 8.5 by 11 paper taped together in a weird T shape for some reason. And, you know, that was just really rough sketch outline, just like single pencil line, kind of like, this is where this nation is. And later on, it was my job to take that map and turn it into the map that we then handed off to a cartographer that became the final map of Galarian. So I actually took it and drew, like, real-looking coastlines and drew in mountain ridges that tried to make sense. And, you know, it broke out my geology and, you know, tectonic plate, you know, guidebooks, and just was like, okay, does this make sense? Where would the deserts be? Okay, they would be here, right? You know, and just tried to figure out some of those things. So, you know, and once we had all of that pulled together, Eric and I set out to write the Gazetteer, which was just like, you know, one-page snippets on each nation, or like half page, just kind of giving everyone an idea about what was in the world. And, you know, from there, it's just kind of a build-as-you-can sort of environment. So it's a staggeringly, monumentally large task. You know, You throw 5 or 6 years at it, and the efforts of, you know, at this point, dozens and dozens of staff and freelancers, and, yeah, you end up with something pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I like the fact that Pathfinder is so young in the regards that it's not impossible to keep pace with it, the fact that I can learn constantly. Because one of the things I love about Paizo and Pathfinder in general is there's always new books coming out. And it's not at the ridiculous pace of, say, TSRs back in the day. Like, hey, here's a million source books. Good luck. But with this, they're always substantial. You learn something new. It adds something new to the world. One of the more recent releases from Paizo is you guys put out a book called The Occult Adventures, I think it is. And it adds it's not just supernatural vampires, spooky stuff. It's actual talking about psychics and something that's very similar to Avatar: The Last Airbender, with like one of the kind of classes, actually the kineticists, I think it is. So with being able to add different layers to the game with something like Occult Adventures, what did you guys want to add with that?
So Occult Adventures is a book that we kind of refer to in-house as a skin book. And what I mean is it's like a template or a skin that you can put on top of your game and flavor it in a different way. So Occult Adventures allows you to take your campaign, or just a one adventure, and really kind of flavor it towards the strange and mysterious world of the occult. And what I mean by that is, you know, within every obvious truth, there is actually a secret, and behind that secret is a cabal that wants to control it. And, you know, there's layers upon layers, and even if you destroy the cabal, the secret masters of that cabal that put it in motion, they're still out there. And, you know, the people who delve into this stuff very frequently also delve into the secrets of the mind, kind of the hidden magic that no one talks about. So for us, it was a good opportunity. Occult Adventures provided a great opportunity for us to explore kind of psychic magic in our game. We didn't want to do the 3.5 psionic system. That was something we kind of left to Dreamstart Press. They were doing a great job with it, so we didn't want to really mess with it. So instead, you know, when it came to Occult Adventures, we just kind of decided to take it in a different way. So psychic magic works mostly like regular magic, except that it has different components. It has emotion and thought components instead of verbal and somatic. The spellcasters still work the same way. So those that come to this book will find it new and refreshing. The classes are very different and interesting. But at its heart, it's still the mechanics they already know, which makes integrating it into your game a whole lot easier. So the book has six classes in it, right? You mentioned the kineticist, which is a character that can call upon elemental forces almost at will to create various wondrous kind of effects. So they can shoot fire or lightning, or they can maybe even do telekinesis. That's the kineticist. And then there's the medium, who calls spirits from, you know, in the deep astral into itself, and uses those spirits to enhance and empower itself. So the great part about the medium is the medium can be a different character on a different day. So one day you might be more combat-focused, whereas the next day you might need to infiltrate a secret stronghold. So you call the spirit of the trickster into you, and that allows you to be more sneaky that day. So the medium's kind of fun in that way. It allows you to kind of play the jack-of-all-trades character, but only one at a time. Then we have the mesmerist, who's kind of like the classic stage magician in that they have a lot of tricks and things they can pull off. They're kind of like an anti-bard. They can put penalties on people with their hypnotic stare, and eventually even use that to cause damage and things like that. Let's see, that's three of them. So next up is the occultist. The occultist is kind of a fun class. This is a class I designed, specifically. My team designed all the rest of them. But the occultist is a character who is fascinated about the kind of strange esoteric objects. You know, it's not so much about whether or not it's a magic item. It's more about whether or not it's, you know, is that the cool, you know, ring finger of the thrice damned king from 400 years ago? Cool, I need that. Doesn't have to be a magic item. It's just a cool old object, and they use these old objects to cast their spells. They focus their psychic power through these old objects. And we took a lot of inspiration from like Constantine or Hellboy for this class, or even Harry Dresden actually. So that's kind of a fun class. We've also got the psychic, just the straight on psychic. This is like a 9-level psychic spellcaster who has a very wide variety of psychic abilities and powers. And their main focus, like, is all about where their psychic power comes from. That kind of really flavors that class. And then last but not least, we have the spiritualist. And the spiritualist is kind of an interesting cousin to the summoner, in that the spiritualist has this phantom that it can call. But the phantom resides generally within the spiritualist, and she just can manifest it. And it can be manifest in a way that it's like ghostly and insubstantial, or it can become fully kind of realized, ectoplasmically physical, which allows it to attack and take other actions. So, you know, the Occult Adventures has a lot to offer both players and GMs. You know, there's plenty of stuff in the book about various, you know, occult rituals, and there's rules for, like, chakras and mindscapes and exploring the dimension of dreams and all sorts of kind of crazy stuff for GMs to play with. Of course, there's also, you know, feats and spells and magic items and all that other fun stuff that really rounds out our books. So yeah, Occult Adventures is a lot of fun. It's been out now for a little over a month now, and it's been a big success.
One of the cool items I saw in the book there is, and it's something you always see referenced in pop culture, it's the monkey's paw, and I really like that you guys put that in there. You had the like kind of haunted doll, and I think back to that movie from a couple years ago. What was it? I can't remember what it was called now. The really scary one with the doll, but
that doesn't narrow it down. All movies with dolls are scary. but yeah, no, you know, we certainly, this book above kind of all others, we definitely looked at a lot of kind of a bit more modern cultural references and found ways to make fantasy analogs for them. So yeah, the monkey's paw is in there. And guess what? It gives you wishes. Isn't that great? I'm sure nothing will go wrong if you take them. I'm sure it'll be great. So yeah, and you know, haunted dolls, and we've got the I think it's called the murderer's hand. It's a hand that if your hand gets cut off, you can replace your hand with this artifact hand, and I'm sure that'll work out great. I'm sure it won't try and choke you in your sleep. The maniac hand is what it's called. That's right. So anyway, yeah, Occult Adventures has lots of toys, like for, you know, players and GMs alike to add some mystery and some suspense to their game. So it should be fun.
Now, there is one other book that I wanted to talk about, and this, I really think, is something everybody who plays Pathfinder really needs to have in their library, and it's the Pathfinder Game Strategy Guide. This is something I absolutely fell in love with. The fact that it breaks down every class, tells you what you can do. Here's some suggested builds of that. And basically, it simplifies it for players, but also gives kind of GMs a look from the outside saying, maybe I can simplify this for people to make it more fun. So what was the genesis behind making this book?
Well, the strategy guide, I think, you know, when we initially sat down to figure out what this book was, we identified the fact that when most people come to learn a role-playing game, there's somebody at the table who kind of acts as mentor, who helps walk them through all the big decisions of their character and helps them kind of learn the ropes and is there to explain things when, you know, they have a question. And usually that person is not the game master. It can be, but it's usually not. The game master has enough jobs, especially while the table is running. You know, so generally speaking, there's someone else at the table. And we said, well, what if you don't have that person at the table? Maybe we should create a book that kind of serves as your guidebook to the core rulebook. So, you know, the core rulebook is kind of an intimidating beast. It's 576 pages. It weighs almost 5 pounds. It's kind of a big book. And for a new player to say, hey, do you want to kill dragons and take their stuff and play a mighty barbarian who, you know, rampages across the countryside? Great, read this 500-page book, is not exactly the best way to get people interested in your game. So the strategy guide was really kind of created to give us a way to be like, okay, so you're new here. We get that. That's cool. Let's walk you through the process of creating your character. That's the most important first step for any new player to the game. So we're going to walk you through each individual step. And we're not going to start off by trying to talk to you about classes or feats or spells or anything like that. We're just going to ask you questions about what kind of character you want to play. Do you want to play the fire mage? Great. Do you want to play the, you know, the valiant warrior who charges across the field on a mount? You know, we got you covered. Do you want to play the, you know, the sneaky thief who hides in the shadows? Great, we got that role, you know. And really just kind of walks you through the process of building a character in a much more kind of natural, the way that most of us do it, which is like, all right, I come up with an idea, then I find out what class matches that idea, then I start, you know, and just walks you through all the decisions you need to make the character you want to play. So that's kind of like the first two-thirds of the book, actually, is just kind of walking you through the character creation process. And it does that, you know, for all 11 classes, giving you multiple different options for each one. But once you're done with that, it's like, okay, well, it's time to play the game. And obviously, you know, we want to walk you through the rules about how the game is actually played. But we want to do it in a way that actually is kind of talking directly to you and isn't so necessarily deeply concerned about the technical language. That way, you know, if there's any question, you have that to fall back on. This is much more conversational. It's like, hey, it's, you know, welcome to combat, you know, it's time to roll initiative, and here's a flowchart that shows you how the initiative round goes and how combat actually works. So really, it's just kind of taking the time to explain things in a much more user-friendly manner than a rules-focused manner. And it also, you know, then spends a good deal of time talking about the various concepts and rules you're going to run into in the game and where you can find more information and what they generally mean. Because the worst part about joining a new game is just not knowing the lingo and not understanding kind of what anyone's talking about. You don't need to know all the rules for the monk when you're playing a fighter. But you maybe need to know that a monk is a thing that exists and that they are, you know, what their general gist is and how they work. So that's kind of was our goal with the strategy guide, and I think it came off pretty well.
Absolutely. It's one thing I always carry with me whenever I go to my Tuesday night kind of Pathfinder sessions, because it's a nice quick reference, too, if you just want to figure out, okay, what can I do with X class? So I want to shift focus as we begin to kind of wrap things up here. Pathfinder has spun off into different kind of media over the last couple of years, and you guys have done audiobooks, you guys have done the Pathfinder comic book series, which is utterly fantastic. How did that relationship get started?
Well, most of that stuff, you know, when it comes to like audiobooks and comic books and, you know, felt or vinyl toys and stuff like that, there are various companies out there that look for marketing opportunities and look for options. And, you know, as we've grown and kind of gained popularity, we've attracted a lot of attention. We get offers almost constantly from people wanting to license Pathfinder and what we do to make some sort of product. And, you know, we kind of have a whole team here now. It's not a big team, but we have a team that their entire job is just to kind of look at those opportunities and manage the ones that we're engaged in. So, you know, we're always looking for a good way to kind of bring Pathfinder to more people. You know, comic books are certainly a way to kind of showcase our world in a graphic format that we can't do any other way. Audio dramas are kind of the same thing. So, you know, we're always looking for a good opportunity. You know, there's a lot of exciting stuff we've actually got cooking that I can't talk about, but there's some really fun stuff floating around out there. I mean, you know, for example, one thing that I can talk about is, you know, Obsidian is doing a app version of the Pathfinder card game, you know, which is pretty exciting, and we're hoping that releases soon. So, you know, new expressions and new ways to bring our games to new people is kind of one of the things we're always keeping an eye out for.
Absolutely. Like, I'm really hoping, because I know there was some unfortunate news earlier this year with the Pathfinder Online having some difficulties, and I really sincerely hope that project will come back to life with a real ferocity, because that's something I really want to see the Pathfinder world expand into, is video games in the worst way.
Yeah, us too. I mean, you know, most of the staff plays video games in some way, shape, or form. Many of us play MMOs. Many of us play, you know, single-player, you know, console games and stuff like that. You know, so we're always really excited about those sorts of things. And, you know, like all ventures, sometimes they don't quite pan out the way you want them to. And we're certainly learning some of those lessons. But, you know, we have high hopes that it'll stick around. And we've got even bigger plans for the future. So we'll see how it plays.
Definitely excited for that. So I guess, Jason, as my final question, this is something now, because I can ask you, because you are the lead designer, and it's something me and my players have argued about for the better part of 2 years now. How do you kill the Tarrasque? Because we have no idea.
That's up to your GM to decide. That's not my call.
See, we were looking at the Pathfinder adventure path, and there's one adventure path where we think we could realistically do this. It's Iron Gods. If we nuked it with nothing but plasma rifles, we could in theory do this.
Yeah, no, conceivably. Yeah, no, it's funny, because when it came time for us to do the bestiary, right, you know, it was one of those things where you're going to the bestiary and you're designing and redesigning monsters in some cases. And we approached those, a lot of the classics at the very least, with kind of the same philosophy we approached everything else, which was just kind of like, how can we make this cooler while not making it too complicated or no fun, right? You know, it was just, and we got to the Tarrasque and it was just like, this needs to be the baddest monster in the book, by far. Hands down, this needs to be the nightmare beast in this book. So, you know, we just kept adding stuff to it until it was, right? I mean, you know, the old 3.5 solution for the Tarrasque was just cast fly. It couldn't hurt you. So we're like, oh, no, it needs a ranged attack. We can throw spines at you. Yeah, sure, let's do that. And, you know, so we just started playing around with ideas. And you know, we always have fun with that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, players love to come up with ways to kill the unkillable things. So, you know, they're basically roving murder hobos. So that's kind of their job.
I got to say, Jason, this has been a fantastically fun conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us here on This Week in Geek. Can you hold the line for just a minute?
Yeah, sure can.
All right, guys. Well, that was my interview with Jason Bowman, the lead designer over at Paizo for Pathfinder. This is the game, like I said, that really brought my love back for tabletop role-playing. I've got a huge library of Pathfinder stuff. I love talking with these guys because I always get a real gamer's perspective on this stuff. And it's not corporate answers that I get from when I do interviews with people who do video games or other such media. I get more organic answers out of people like this. And I sincerely hope you guys have got something out of this interview. You've learned something neat. If you want to find out more information about Pathfinder, go to paizo.com. That's P-A-I-Z-O.com. Check out their stuff. Highly recommend you check out the Pathfinder adventure card game. That's a lot of fun. I talked with Tanis O'Connor about that earlier this year, so go check out that interview. Ask your local comic retailer. Check out the Pathfinder comics. One of the really neat things about that is when they do the collected editions, they look like Pathfinder source books. They come with stats and maps. Check that out. That's the main reason I get them. Plus, the stories are really good too. So anyway, guys, for Botched Roll in This Week in Geek, I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd saying, let's hope you never roll a natural one.
Wanna see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
What the hell happened to George Lucas?
Oh my god, there's snot on my face. And I'm your host, Mike the Birdman Dub. And I'm not a join. What the f*** does that mean? F*** that. 10 seconds.
Oh, you gotta keep that.
Let's do this. Let's do this right the first time.
F*** you guys. Ew, it's in my mouth. Oh, God.
Oh, what's it taste like, Mike?
Water. Ew, salty.
Let's start this episode with shat.
Okay, I'm good. Geico.
Holy shit. Oh, my gosh. Freak. Die. Holy crap. Whoa. Where did it go?
I'm like a stupid monkey.
As you can imagine, they don't let us out much.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week to hear, somebody random. I don't know. Maybe even a hot chick. Yeah, let's go with that.
Did anyone ever tell you that you were very, very sexy?
How are you? Actually, no.
They never will.
Check out our website, thisweekingeek.net, for more geek content, as well subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Send us a Twitter message by replying to @thisweekingeek. Lastly, you can email us at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. This extra music was produced by Prono Bozo at pronobozo.com. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.